All right, good morning, everyone. We've got a few people in the house today. So typically when I do these talks, this is not the first time I've talked about raising venture capital. My name's John Bassett. I work with a venture fund in Los Angeles, California, called DFJ Frontier. We're a seed stage venture fund. We've got about $100 million under management, and we look to invest in seed and early stage technology companies. We typically invest $500,000 to $1 million up front into the company and try to buy an equity stake in the company and help it grow and see a liquidity event for our investors. So like I said, when I give these talks, I like to make them very interactive. So I'm going to go through. I've got a few slides to present. It's probably 15 to 20 minutes worth of content, and then I'm going to leave a bunch of time at the end for questions, because I'm sure most of you or some of you in the room are thinking about raising money at some point. Am I right about that? Yeah? And so I want to kind of be able to address a question, specific to your business, your industry, the type of financing you're thinking about going after. So please don't hesitate to raise your hand, ask questions when I'm going through stuff, or just speak up. So this is a talk about raising money. So you're probably wondering why the first slide says don't raise money if you don't have to. The reason I tell entrepreneurs not to raise money if you don't have to is that there's a lot of success stories out there of people who never raised a dollar of outside funding, at least not initially. So Dell, HP, and Microsoft, all very big household names, grew to pretty large revenue numbers before they took outside investor capital. Has anyone heard of a company called Esri? They do GIS mapping software. They're 42 years old. They've never taken a dollar of outside investing. In this past year, they did $912 million in revenue. So I point that out to say that it is possible. You don't have to raise outside capital, and if you don't have to, it just keeps you from having the constraints of raising money. So when you take money from a group like ours or other group of investors, you now have other people that you're responsible to. So you now have new owners in the business. You have people who are going to tell you how to try to run things. It varies from angels through professional investors, but they're all going to have different levels of due diligence they want to do and different requirements they need from you. And the important part here is that as an entrepreneur, the most important thing you have is your time. And when you spend time fundraising, you're not spending time building your business. And the most important thing you should be doing early on is building your business, going and finding customers, generating revenue, and really scaling the company. And every minute, day, month you spend fundraising, you're not spending on your business. And the reality is it takes 3 to 6 months on average to raise even a small amount of financing. And that's not 3 to 6 months of casual phone calls. That's 3 to 6 months of airplane flights to different parts of the world, meetings back to back, coffees, lunches, working on your PowerPoint till 4 a.m. to get it right for investors, and just doing all the work, 'cause I'm sure you guys are familiar with. So the problem when you go out and try to raise money is that you're selling investors and not customers. And when you're starting a company, you need to be focusing on selling customers. You need to go out and find out if what you have people are interested in buying and care about, right? Without money, you can't really make fatal mistakes. There is one guarantee, and I guarantee all of you that if you raise money, you will spend it. And when you spend money, the thing I've seen with entrepreneurs and just business in general, as soon as you start taking in money, you stop trying to fix problems and you start throwing money at problems. So for example, if you're having a technical glitch, or you're having problems scaling your stack or your engineering talent, people say, oh, we'll go out and raise a bunch of money and we'll just hire a bunch of smart people to fix these problems. And what you do is you go spend the money and you still don't have a solution to the problem. And when you're lean and you don't have a lot of capital in the business, you actually have to solve problems and you can't just throw money at solutions. So that kind of tacks on a no spending discipline. And then the other problem you have is you're selling equity. Does everyone in the room know what equity is? Oh, it's ownership in your business, right? And so you're giving up equity before you've actually proven a viable business model. And when you do that, you have to give up a bigger chunk of equity because there's uncertainty. So the higher risk involved, the more equity an investor is going to want. And by giving up equity before you've proven the business model, they're going to want a much more large piece of your company, right? So if you wait till actually prove the business, you've got revenue coming in, then you can justify having investors only take a smaller piece of equity. So my next piece of advice for anyone trying to raise money is stop reading tech news. This might be a little bit US-centric, but is everyone in the room familiar with TechCrunch, or has heard of TechCrunch, Pando Daily, some of these other publications? If you start reading TechCrunch, you're going to see these headlines, and they come in every 5 or 10 minutes, and they just float on the screen. And you can literally spend half a day digging through TechCrunch articles and seeing the latest financings. And what happens is I see a lot of times entrepreneurs see a number like this. Facebook buys Instagram for $1 billion, and then they automatically think, now I got to go for the billion-dollar outcome, right? So everyone in the room thinking, how am I going to get to my billion-dollar exit? Sig Fig gets $15 million in Series B. So everyone's like, what am I going to do to get my $15 million Series B? And what I found is that the folks that perseverate over sort of headlines and fundings aren't focused on their business. So I keep coming back to this. The most important thing you can do is spend time on your business. The other problem with companies like Instagram, Pinterest, is that I call it akin to winning the lottery, right? It's like you're going out and buying a raffle ticket. There could have been, there were 100 or 1,000 different companies that could have been the next big Instagram. And Instagram ended up winning. And I can't tell you honestly why. It's probably a big combination of things that happened, and they were a perfect fit for Facebook. But don't build a business that is like winning the lottery. Build a business that actually has a fundamental reason to exist, has real customers, and has a real revenue model. So have you guys heard of the game Angry Birds? Mm-hmm. Do you guys know who makes it? Rovio. Well, this is a pretty fun fact that I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't know. Angry Birds was actually Rovio's 52nd attempt at making a game, and it's the first one that actually took off. And I say that not to discourage anyone in the room and have them say, I'm going to have to try 52 different things to scale a business, but because there is really no overnight success story, right? People read the news and like, Instagram, oh, these guys started a company and 6 months later they sold for $1 billion. No. Even Pinterest in their first year were one of the slowest growth businesses online, and literally the last year it's been the fastest, highest growth business pretty much ever. And I tell you that because as long as you're sure you're doing the right thing and have customer validation and are generating revenue, you got to stick with your business and really keep going after it. But it's not going to be an overnight success. Angry Birds was game number 52, right? And so don't think that just because you don't get initial traction that there's not something there, but maybe reconsider raising serious capital until you've actually proven that there's a viable business model. So all that being said, this is going to lead you to going out and actually raising money, right? And so what I tell entrepreneurs is you need to raise on your terms. There's different ways to raise money, right? You can walk in the room and say, I'll take whatever you guys can give me, or you can go in and say, look, here's why I'm raising money, here's how I'm going to do it, and here's the money I need. So raise on a high note. So let's say you've been working for 6 or 12 months on landing a big client, right? Your $100,000 client that's going to generate some real revenue for you. You want to go into a meeting, and you want to that first meeting to say, hey guys, I've been working on closing this account for the last 6 months. I'm really close to getting it, but I don't have it yet. The next time you meet with that investor, you want to say, six weeks ago I told you I was going to close this account? Well, guess what? I just closed it, and we brought in $100,000 in revenue, right? That's excitement, and there's a little bit of groupthink in investing. And I have an analogy. It's sort of like a train sitting at a train station, right? So if I walk up to the train station and I see the engineer there sort of tinkering with his tools and banging on the engine and sort of building, as an investor, I'm going to say, I can come back in a week or 2 weeks and this train is still going to be here, right? If I come back a week later and all of a sudden the engine's fired up, there's smoke coming out of the stack, the engineer is like painting a number on the side, I'm sort of thinking, wow, if I don't get on this train right now, I'm going to miss the opportunity, right? And so the way you create that sense of urgency is by raising on a high note, by under-promising and over-delivering, by generating revenue-generating clients. And so a follow-up to that is always choose your best cheerleaders. So have you guys heard of a board of advisors or strategic guidance? So what you want to do is you want to find advisors or investors that will work for you. And I always tell people to aim high. Literally make a list of the 10 best people in the world that are in your space or super knowledgeable or doing what you're doing, and go after those people and try to bring one or two of them onto a board to be strategic investors. You might have to give up a little bit of the company in order to do that, but it's often very much worth it in the end. The one caveat with that is make sure they're going to work for you. I've seen a lot of startups, bring on celebrity endorsers or bring on strategic advisors, and they don't clearly define what their ask is of that person. They just say, hey, we want you to be the face of the competition. We want you to be our celebrity endorser. But they don't actually clearly lay out what steps those are. And so if you're going to bring on strategic investors or advisors and give up a certain percentage of your company for them, I encourage you to lay out very clearly defined goals. Like you want them to tweet once a month for you. You want them to bring in, one other strategic advisor that's going to be a value-add member of the team. So you really have to spell out those goals and clearly define them and then strike a partnership that's going to work for both of you. So a few things to keep in mind as you go into fundraising. Sort out your paperwork long before you actually seek funding. Is everybody in this room, have they incorporated as a business? Filed paperwork? Yes? Great. And so it's going to vary by what country you're from and what the different legal structures offer you there. But the single most important thing you can do is set that out at the outset. And I've got a couple examples of where it hasn't worked because groups haven't set aside equity or discussed different roles within the company. One is husband-wife combo. We've invested in a company where a couple actually divorced in the middle of raising the business. And it was a very uncomfortable situation because one wanted to stay with the business and one wanted to go. And because at the outset they hadn't clearly defined pre-negotiated equity splits and what would happen if one left and not the other, if the business would shut down or keep going, it had to be settled in court. So that was not a, you know, a particularly good situation. The other is we oftentimes have best friends that start businesses together. And I've seen it work really well, and I've seen it not work. And so I think the most important thing there is outlining at the beginning what each person's role is within the business and what the equity split is at the outset. And then there's a term called vesting. And what that means is your equity, you start to get your equity over time. So typically you put, you know, equity and shares on a vesting schedule. So for example, what's typical in the U.S. right now is a 4-year vesting schedule with a 1-year cliff. So what that means is if you're promised 10% of the company, or let's say 8% of the company to make numbers easy, over 4 years you get 2% of your equity, you get earned each of the first 4 years up until you own your full 8%, and you don't get any of it until you've worked for 12 months. That's the 1-year cliff. And the reason for that is you'll often find out in working, you know, with someone that hey, you may not work that well together, or hey, you know, the business wasn't working in the direction that you initially wanted to go, but there's some traction in this other direction and your entrepreneur friend or partner wants to go that way. But you need to have those clearly defined terms so you can cut loose at any time and say, hey, this isn't working for me. I'm going to go do something else. But I'm not going to take half the company with me because it's been vested over, you know, a period of time and we had some time to figure out what works and what didn't. So those are some sort of high-level points on how to raise funding, and now I want to jump into the different types of funding available. So there's three main types of funding available to your business. There's debt financing, which is like taking a loan, line of credit, credit card debt, bank loan. There's grants, which are typically given out by governments, universities, education institutes. And then there's equity investors, which I'm an equity investor. I work for a venture capital firm. So we give you money, and in return, we take equity. And so what a lot of people don't know is that debt financing is actually far and away the most common form of financing for a business, right? The problem is that debt financers typically want a loan against assets. And so it makes a lot of sense for a company that has a manufacturing operation, that has a lot of hardware like infrastructure, trucks, owns their own real estate, things like that. A bank can loan against those underlying assets and get a return even if the business doesn't work. Most of you in this room are probably doing technology-related or manufacturing and hardware and don't have a lot of assets to loan against. So this probably isn't going to be your first choice of financing, but if you do have assets you can loan against, it's something I recommend doing. The pros are you don't have to give up any ownership of the business, typically. It's available to companies that can't raise equity financing, but you're going to have to pay interest. They're not going to necessarily be strategic investors in your company. If a bank gives you a loan, they're not usually going to sit with you and say, here's how we think you should run your business. This is where, you know, there's some weaknesses in your team. They're going to say, here's our money. Pay it back in X amount of time with X amount of interest, right? So here's the check. Go do your thing. And you may need to put up collateral. Oftentimes, entrepreneurs have to mortgage their home, mortgage a vehicle. It can be, you know, scary for a lot of people if you don't have the appetite or aren't sure about the success of your business. So the next most common are grants. There's literally billions of dollars in free money out there if you know how to get it. And the pros are that it can be free money other than a lot of work and a lot of headache, and you're going to spend a lot of time writing for grants that you may or may not actually win. Another pro is that a lot of times investors, like equity investors, if they see money going into the business that's not going to take equity away, they're willing to pile on behind that and get some equity in the business because they know there's stability because you have plenty of money in the bank to grow and succeed. The cons are that they tend to be very competitive because it is literally free money. You just have to write a grant. A lot of people compete for them. And it's a very strict use of funds, very clearly defined set of goals. Typically, there'll be like an initiative or a goal set forth. And then you have to structure your business around those very, very strict use of funds. And if you go outside of those, you typically have to pay back the grant or forfeit some of the money or things like that. So I encourage everyone. I know Microsoft has a big grant I think they're going to talk about or give away later. A lot of universities, institutions have them. There's different places to look for them depending on what country you're in and what industry you're working in. So the thing I'm most knowledgeable on is equity financing. It's what I do for a living. I work for a fund. We have $100 million, and we invest in startups. And so there's typically, four different groups that you can go to. Friends and family tend to be the easiest, right? They tend not to be very knowledgeable on the business, and they'll give you money because you are who you are, right? They want to invest in their son or daughter. They want to invest in their niece or nephew, cousin, you know, grandkid. And so if you need a little bit of money early on before you really have a business, that's typically the way to go. They often don't make you structure any documents. They often don't have clearly defined equity positions. They often just say, here's $20,000, go make some money. I really believe in what you're doing. You know, I love you. You know, go, good luck. So they're great people to know, but they're not always the most strategic investors, and they're not always going to add a lot of value. The other thing I've seen is a lot of people tend to have a burden of responsibility when they take money from friends and family in a way that they don't from outside investors. And a lot of people feel very guilty if they lose family members' money. So just be aware of your own sort of personality type and how you deal with loss or dealing with other family members, because it can make a very uncomfortable Christmas conversation or, you know, holiday meal if you've lost your family $20,000. And they're always going to want to know, how's the business? How are things going? So it's a good form of financing, but just be wary. Angels. Has everyone in the room heard the term angel investor? So these are typically investors that have had some success in the business world or independently wealthy, and they want to give back to the community. They typically invest anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 per angel, and they often form groups of investors, angel groups. So you might get 10 angels to each put in $20,000, and you'll go out and raise $20,000 for your business. Their typical investors are not always the most savvy, but depending on where you go, some can be, you know, way better than venture investors. Other can be almost more like friends and family. Strategic investors are those folks who are in your space. So if you're building all Windows applications, Microsoft might be a really great investor for you because they know the platform intimately. They can do development to help your company succeed on the platform and vice versa. You can provide a lot of great feedback to them. They can help you know how to best utilize their system. So I'm always wary of strategic investors only because I've seen investors fund companies because they want to know what your technology is. And by investing in your company, they sort of have rights to come in and dig through your code and do whatever they want to do. They're usually not out to get you, but once they've got what they want and understand how you're doing things, there's much less of an impetus for them to acquire you. Once they know how you do things and who your clients are and how you're selling your software, they're less interested in buying your company. And then the last is venture capitalists or private equity, which is the group I belong to. Typically invest $250,000 and up. And we do everything from seed and early stage investing, which can be two people in a business plan, up through $100 million rounds for companies like Waze or, you know, companies that have grown really large. So these are just some quick numbers on how much money you can typically expect from each group of investor. So that helps kind of make the decision of who you should target first and what sort of strategic advice you need from them. So I always tell people raising money is a lot like dating. I don't know if everyone in the room has any experience dating or not, but you want to stand out from the competition, right? You're going to make yourself look better, you know, be prettier, have more features than everyone else in your space, right? And so the way you do that is by going out and getting customers, by having a good story, by going and getting press. You want to make yourself really stand out. The other thing, like I said, there's a little bit of groupthink in the investment world. And so when you can make investors gossip, when you can give them a piece of, you know, just a piece of information that's like you're the first to tell them, or you send them a hot deal, or you talk about a whole new technology they've never heard of before, you get us gossiping, right? And we run in small circles. We all see each other at different places around the city. And so we start talking. And if you can get us talking about your deal, that's a great way to get funding. Never sound desperate. I get a lot of emails. There's a classy way to follow up with people after an interview or after a meeting, and there's very tacky ways. And the tacky ways are, hey, if I don't get money right now, you're totally going to miss out on this opportunity. Hey, I can't believe you didn't, you know, write us a check on the spot. You know, we're the next biggest thing since Microsoft. Like, you'd be surprised, but I get a lot of emails like this. Don't sound desperate, because you're very unlikely to get money if you do. Divorces are messy, so you really want to pick your partners wisely. Not all money is the same. So a dollar is not a dollar in the investment world. A dollar with the right partners and the right strategic advice can be worth hundreds of dollars. And a dollar from someone who has the wrong intentions, wrong motives, or doesn't know your industry can actually be worth negative to you. So make sure you pick your partners carefully and don't just take the first money that comes across your desk. And it's often a numbers game. I'll get into the venture capital model for our firm here, but we see a lot of deals every year, And oftentimes, we don't select your company, not because it's not the right fit or not because you're not awesome people. It could be just the wrong time. We could have just done a couple deals and we can't, you know, we don't have enough staff to go and do due diligence on another deal right now. So come back later. Or there's a million reasons we don't do a deal. So it's not always you. It's not always the idea. It's not always the business. So don't take it personally. This is a venture capital model. For every 10 companies we fund, we want one of them to return at least 10 times our money and make back for all the other losses of the fund. Two to three deals are going to lose all our money, at least at the seed stage. Three or four hopefully get their money back, and then two or three hopefully double or triple our money, right? And I think the important thing for entrepreneurs to remember is that our job as investors is to make more money for our investors. So just like you're all entrepreneurs and you go out and pitch us, we're entrepreneurs too in that we have to go out and raise money from high net worth individuals. So for us to raise a $100 million fund, we have to go out and find people willing to write $5, $10, $15 million checks to our fund to go out and then invest in startups. So in the same way we ask you to take our money and return it tenfold, the guys who give us money ask us to invest their money and return it tenfold. So we're very similar to you in that we're out pitching investors, we're out running a business, we're out trying to make more money for our investors. But the important thing to keep in mind is if you take venture money, you have to get an exit at some point. If you never raise outside money, you can run a lifestyle business. You never have to get an exit. You can just spit off revenue and you can ride off into the sunset. But if you take outside investors' money, you have 10 years to go out and either get acquired or sell the company and get us our money back. So the rules of the game sort of change, and just keep that in mind. If you want this to be your, you know, your career project and then pass it on to, you know, your son or daughter or your family, venture investing might not be the right way to get capital because you need to get an exit. So here's just some quick statistics. In the U.S. in 2012, there was $26 billion invested in venture investments across 3,700 startups. At the seed stage, it was a lot lower number, $725 million. Most of you are probably going to be at the seed stage, which is, you know, the first sort of money in, $250,000 to $500,000. Some of you may be at early stage where you're raising closer to a million or two. And this stat always really surprises entrepreneurs. So the group I worked for last year, I reviewed 2,100 deals approximately. I took meetings or phone calls with 300, and we funded three. So when I said don't take it personally, I really mean that. There was way more than three venture-backable businesses. There was way more than three high-quality entrepreneurs. But that's what the business is. And so when you know that, I think it just helps to, you know, you're going to have to see a lot of different venture funds if you want to raise venture capital, right? So please don't take it personally if you don't raise money from the first VC you talk to or if you never raise money from a VC. But out of, call it 2,000 deals, we seriously looked at 300 and we did three. So it's a very competitive funnel. So whether or not you raise outside capital or raise another dollar, if you want to build a business, there's three questions that really matter. Can anybody guess what questions you need to ask yourself and be able to answer in order to raise money? Don't be shy. You guys are entrepreneurs. You can't be shy. Yes? That's a great one. It's not one of the three I have here, but it's very important to like figure out how to contact angels, right? These are the three questions that I think really matter, and you have to be able to answer and look in the mirror and know these cold before you go out and raise money. So, what problem am I solving? You guys are lion sharp, lion share? All right, would you guys stand up and tell me in one sentence what problem you're solving?
Okay, I'm solving a problem of people who want to work with ideas, who have a project in their mind and have to organize it. So I'm providing a tool and application that allows people to work with it. It's a gesture control, voice control application where people can do that.
Perfect. Perfect. No, that's great. That's great. Thank you. Who else? I'm gonna make most of you guys do it. Yeah, stand up. One sentence. What problem are you solving? Okay. So the problem is that people are not doing physical, people are not completing their physical therapy.
Exactly.
Great. Cool. Who else? I'm going to make you all do it, so just pick the order you want to do it in. What problem are you solving?
Well, just I think that we still don't have enough funds, so I'm here to give more people more fun. That's
great. So you're helping them have more fun through video games, right?
Yes.
So you're helping people build video games to have more fun.
Yes. Definitely.
Great. Great. Yes. One behind you. Yeah, go ahead.
Set up smart place to help and assist people suffering from dementia.
Okay, so the problem is there's a whole group of in society that's suffering from dementia. And is that a, do you see that as a monetary problem, meaning it's causing, it's like a capital problem, or do you see it as like a health and wellness problem? Okay, but you're, so you're basically solving the problem that there's a huge group in society that has dementia and they need help. More or less, that's your problem? Okay, great. Okay, so the problem is that there's dyslexic children who have problems reading, right? So I challenge all of you, when you're talking about your problems, really focus on what the problem is, not on what your business is. Because so often you want to start talking about the solution, and this is what I do. You're so excited to be out there telling people about what you're doing, but really focus on the problem, right? So the problem is that there's, you know, a whole group of dyslexic, you know, people that are having a hard time learning, right? And so who has this problem? There's this whole dyslexic population, right? And are they willing to pay for the solution? Those are the questions we're going to ask, and so you have to be able to answer those. So thank you. Yes?
We are providing people a device that makes them control anything on tablet, PCs, and smartphones from anywhere, like walls, tables, anything.
So what do you think the problem is? Like, why do you think we need this solution? Okay, so you think it's the current way we interact with computers is somewhat difficult, or different connected devices?
Maybe you are in another room and you need to do something in your laptop.
Right.
Okay, and you can do it from anywhere.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. So again, just to the extent that I see this all the time with entrepreneurs, right? As soon as you start talking about your idea, you want to talk about the solution, right? And the problem is, we all think we know what the right solution is, but we often haven't done enough research to figure out, really, are we attacking the problem the right way? So if you step back and say, what problem am I solving? Just at a very high level, right? I'm helping dyslexic people. There's a whole population of dyslexic, you know, individuals that cannot read. That is the problem, right? The dyslexic, you know, dyslexic have this problem, and then you need to go out and find out if people are willing to pay. So instead of jumping in, and I don't mean to pick on your group at all, but instead of jumping in and saying, you know, we develop technology or software that helps dyslexic people read, that's what your company does. That's not the problem. The problem is there's a whole group in society that has learning difficulties, and it's a burden on the education system, it's a burden on society, it's a burden on the individuals, right? And so then if you look at it through that lens, you can go and say, who really has this problem? And you can drill into the numbers and say 100,000 people, a million people, and then you can say, and who's willing to pay for this, right? And oftentimes it might be the individuals, but oftentimes it might not. It might be the school system, it might be counselors and advisors. There's a whole group of people there, and so when you start at this sort of top level and work your way down, you might look at your business in a different light. So instead of saying, I know what the solution is, and here's what I build, you say, here's the problem, here's who has the problem, and here's who's willing to pay for it. And if anywhere along the way you actually don't see an answer to this question, like you can't actually clearly define the problem, you probably don't have a business. If you can't actually tell me concisely who has the problem, how many people, what they look like, you might not have a business. And if you can't tell me if people are willing to pay for the solution, you definitely don't have a business. And so, you know, that's the most important thing is having customers, right? And the customer is who pays you for your solution. So, again, I'm going to talk about the dyslexic group here. So the end user of the product might be the student that is dyslexic and can't read, right? But your customer might actually be the school system if they buy the software. And so it's really important to differentiate who you're helping and who the customer is. The customer is always the person that pays you for what you're building, and you need to build your product for the customer, right? You need to sell the benefits of the product to the customer. And when you go through this process, you're going to start getting into a lot of the key features of building a business, and that's things like market validation, customer segmentation, you know, things like this. And so you really, really need to spend time asking yourself these questions. What's my problem? Who has this problem? And are people willing to pay for it? And it sounds like such a simple thing, but as I've seen, you know, a lot of people have stand up and said, here's what my company does, and that's not the problem. So really spend some time thinking, what's the problem, how many people have it, and who's willing to pay? The next thing I'll say is that getting to a decision is probably one of the single most important things you can do. And too often entrepreneurs are afraid to get a no, right? Nobody wants to hear no. Let's face it, everyone wants to hear yes. For whatever they're doing, yes. Tell me yes. Can I go out, Mom? Can I stay out late? Yes. Can I have some money, Mom, to go to a movie? Yes. So everyone wants to hear a yes. But the problem is, like I said before, time is your most important asset, right? It's all you have when you're building a business initially. You don't have money, you don't have a lot of technical talent, you don't have a full team often. So all you have is time. And the more time you spend fundraising, the less time you spend building your business, right? And what I see is a lot of entrepreneurs are scared to get a no. So they'll go into a pitch meeting, they'll get all the way through the presentation, and then they'll say, okay, thank you for your time. They'll never say, I'm raising $500,000, are you interested in investing? I need $50,000. Would you be willing to have a conversation about, you know, funding my company at that level? I'm raising $1 million. You know, is this something you're interested in, right? And nobody asked because everyone's afraid to get a no, right? I saw some people out here nodding like, oh, that kind of makes sense. So some of you may have been through it. Others of you maybe haven't. But, you know, it might not always be appropriate on the very first meeting to ask for money. But certainly after the second or third, you need to make the ask and not be afraid of getting a no, right? So just really, really keep that in mind. And the other thing people, you know, without fail, when you end your meetings, always ask, is there anyone else you think I should talk to? Right? Because the other thing is there anything else I should know? And is there anything else you think, anyone else you think I should talk to? Because if you just leave with the ask, finish and walk out, you're done. There's no more leads, right? But if you say, is there anything else you think I should know? You've asked all your questions. They've asked you all their questions, but you've just opened up an opportunity for them to tell you whatever they want. They can say, you know, sure, yeah, I don't think you should be doing this business because I've seen 10 others like it. Or they can say, I really like that idea, but it's not good for me because. And then you say, is there anyone else you think I should talk to? Then they might give you an opportunity for other potential investors, strategic advisors. They might have just had a company come in before that said, hey, this isn't working out. I've got a couple really good tech guys. Do you know anywhere else that's, you know, looking to hire developers? So by asking those open-ended questions when you leave, you give yourself an opportunity to have more leads, more potential for financing and strategic team members and everything else. So that's pretty much the high-level pitch of how to get your company funded. And now, you know, I'll kind of leave it open for any and all questions. Please ask away. We've got, you know, up to a half an hour, I think, to answer questions. So what questions do you guys have for me? None. I answered every single question there possibly is about funding. So there's two industries that used to get a lot of attention and now get less. I'd say that's healthcare and clean energy. And part of the reason is they've gotten so expensive in terms of, you know, in the life science deals, there's FDA approvals, which have gotten really expensive. There's working with insurance industries. There's this whole new category of businesses that cost so much money to build and grow successfully. That being said, I'd really focus your search on those companies that do invest. There are, you know, a select number of funds that all they do is healthcare technology, you know, working with insurance industries. They're out there and they exist, and I'm happy to share some of those names with you offline. But I would say it's got less universal appeal than it once did, but there's still a big group of investors that solely want to invest in healthcare IT, technology solutions, things like that. So don't hesitate. Don't think you need to, you know, reconsider how to do things. On a personal level, I believe that the U.S., for one, has a lot of healthcare issues, and I think they're going to be solved consumer first. So I think we need to get a lot of these devices into the consumer, and when enough consumers start using a device and asking for it, you'll eventually start to see a shift. It'll be slow, but I think it's going to come from the consumer. That's just a personal, you know, personal aside, so take that with a grain of salt. But if enough people start asking for the same thing in the same sort of health and wellness circles, eventually there will be a change in mass adoption. So what else? I know you guys all have questions. There's no bad question. How can you find me? Well, you can find me right here. Please don't email, call anytime. I'm around today if you guys want to, you know, chat one-on-one. You guys can email me business plans. You can email me one-pagers. You can email me executive summaries. You can email me with questions. I try to respond to every email. So please don't hesitate to reach out. Yeah? Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm asking about how we can verify and verifications and validation discuss this point?
Yeah, I wish I had a whiteboard. So I think one way I'll answer that question is we talk a lot about doing small experiments, right? So think of a bullseye, right? Like concentric rings. You've got one in the middle and you've got bigger and bigger rings. So I always say start in the middle with the free experiment, right? So let's say, what's your business again? Right. Great. So a free example of a free experiment that just takes your time is doing a survey, right? So you go out and talk to 1,000 people or do an internet survey and start asking questions around your business, right? So is this something you'd be interested in using? How do you currently interact with different connected devices? So you basically you build a queue of people that answer questions for you for free, right? And assuming that you still feel good about the business, you get positive responses, you do a little bit more expensive experiment, right? Maybe you run a $500 Google AdWords campaign, right? And you have people go to a dummy page. You just build a landing page that basically pitches what you do, right? And then you start buying keywords around that. And if people start clicking through and you get validation, then maybe you spend $2,000 to do a little bit more expensive experiment, right? So each step along the way, you start free, and assuming you're still getting positive feedback and seeing a lot of interest in your business, spend a little bit more money. And so that way you're not going out and spending $50,000 or $500,000 initially, but you're getting validation. And once you've built enough of that validation, then you go maybe raise $50,000 to get the project off the ground. Continue to do these experiments. Continue to get market validation. Continue to understand your customer and why they're buying. And as you continue to do that, you raise a little bit more money. You go to part B of your business plan. You go to part C. So start small and work your way bigger. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Not, and girls, we're not really business people so much. And we've made a crack at making a business plan. When you walk into, when you have somebody pitch an idea to you,
sure.
How, you know, I could go out and spend a ton of money to get somebody to help me write a business plan. But what kind of level of expertise
All right.
is expected at that?
Here's my $1 million piece of advice, right? To not spend a lot of money on a business plan. So here it is.
Okay.
If everybody in this room should do a business plan.
Right.
Do it yourself and never show it to anyone. I'm serious about that, right?
Okay.
You need to do it yourself because it asks all the hard questions and asks you all the things you wouldn't normally think of. If you're a developer, all you think about is code. If you're a marketer, all you do is think about marketing opportunities for your business, right? And you as the founder of the company, if you build the entire business plan from the ground up, you're forced to think about marketing, sales strategy, how to price your product. What's the development cycle going to look like? What's the code base going to look like? Who's going to potentially buy? How much money do we need? These are all questions that you never want to think about because it's not your key interest, right? If you're a developer, you don't want to think about sales and marketing, but you need to. If you're a sales guy, the last thing you want to do is understand code, but you need to, right? But this isn't a document you share. Like, if you send me a business plan, I probably won't read it. If you ask me to, I'll scan it and I'll provide some feedback, but I'm not going to read 25 pages of a Word document to get you some advice, right? Business plans are not what they once were in the investing community, but I still think they're incredibly, incredibly valuable so that you think about all the components of your business. So go home and do one and then lock it away in a cabinet, but have done it and fill out all the sections and answer all the questions in a way that you understand and is meaningful, but then don't ever share it with anyone. My first piece of advice is you don't. If you want our money, please reach out. But my second piece of advice is this. There's far more startups in the world than there is capital to fund them. And as long as that's the case, investors will have more of the choice of which companies they want to fund. Does that make sense? If there was enough money to fund all startups, then it wouldn't matter. You could really go around and choose and say, I want money from you, I want money from you, I want money from you guys. But in the world and the way it exists, there's far and away, as I showed you, I saw 2,100 companies that wanted our money, and we gave it to 3 of them. It doesn't mean a lot of those companies didn't go out and get money somewhere else, but not all 2,000 of them raised money. And so as long as there's too little money chasing too many companies, it's going to be sort of in the investor's favor to kind of do which deals they want to do. That being said, I still go out and I try to find startups all the time. I talk to my developer friends and figure out what services they're using. I go out and figure out what the hottest, latest technology is. I spend a lot of time working with junior highs and high schools. They were the first ones to really break Snapchat. I don't know if you guys know what Snapchat is. But I spend a lot of time going out and trying to find deals. So the best deals tend not to come to us. We have to go out and find them. So I think, to answer your question, we will, if you have the right product and right revenue and are, you know, building an incredible business, we will find you. But don't hesitate to reach out, because we see so many different companies. It's going to be hard to find you unless you really stand out for some reason.
And what else are you offering besides money?
So I think money is just kind of the gateway in. And every firm's a little bit different. And I encourage you, ask the people you go raise money from where they add value, but also just talk to people in the community. Go out and say, hey, what's DFJ Frontier's reputation, right? We list the companies we funded on our website, and we give people's email addresses. I'd encourage you to call up other CEOs and say, why'd you take those guys' money? Did they add value? How did they add value? So don't just take our word for it, but go and find out from other people who have gotten our money or other investors. We, for one, tend to take a board seat, so we become board members. And as part of that, we help sort of drive the strategic direction and vision of the business. It's everything from defining a revenue model, figuring out how to price your product, to helping you make key hires at, you know, the executive level. So we kind of help wherever you need help, but we're not going to run the business for you. So we're not day-to-day. We're not in there, you know, hiring and firing people. We're there, you know, we're there available. We usually have a weekly board call. We usually have monthly board meetings. And we try to be as helpful as possible without running the business. So different firms have different relationships. You know, we have very strong media and technology relationships in and around California. So if your business is involved in media and needs access to, you know, Hollywood studios or music production or other things like that, that's certainly a strong point of ours. And every firm is going to have sort of their key group of folks that they're closest with that can really add value. So ask around and find out what that is. So I could probably do a whole presentation on that, but at a high level, venture investors tend to like software because there tends to be, you know, a one cost to build the software, and then you can sell it infinite number of times. Does that make sense? So you have a development cost to build your software, but you can sell that software to as many people as you want. With hardware, for each piece, you know, for each piece of hardware you build, there's another input cost. So for each unit you sell, you need to spend more money creating that unit. With software, you can build it once and sell it infinite number of times. So it tends to be a much higher return on software, and you as a company tend to get much better multiples. I would say yes, because you need a lot more money, typically. You need more money in the hardware business to build your prototype, to scale manufacturing, and so it's usually harder for investors to put money into hardware businesses unless you've already proven that there's a lot of demand. And one thing I've seen that's worked really well is, are you familiar with like Kickstarter or some of these crowdfunding platforms? That seems to work really well for hardware devices, and it's a great way to raise, you know, some companies have raised over $10 million on Kickstarter. But it's a great way to raise money for hardware or consumer devices without taking dilution of your equity. So by doing that, you see if there's validation, if people are interested in your product. And for example, there's an Ouya open source gaming console. They raised $10 million, and then Kleiner Perkins came in and gave them $40 million more because they'd already proved that there's demand in the market. They'd already built a prototype. They'd already sourced manufacturing. And so it was easy for a venture investor to come in and say, you've already done all the hard work and taken the risk out of the business. Let me give you some more money. Whereas in software, it's much easier to say, okay, for $500,000 or $1 million, you can develop your software and sell it 1 million times. Whereas in hardware, for each piece you create, you have to spend more money. So hardware is typically less favorable to venture investors and more favorable to debt investors. But there's still people out there funding hardware. So don't get discouraged at all. But consider some other like crowdfunding sources. Yeah, so get their money back is it's tough to say that they exactly get their money back, but oftentimes what will happen is a company will start building a business and they'll see a lot of success, right? well, markets might change, they might lose a really big customer, and so the business is changing. And you have an opportunity then to say, do I want to find a new business and go out and raise more money and build in that direction? Or do I want to sell this business and try to start something new or go work for another company? And so when you face that decision, there's often an opportunity to sell your business for the amount of money that's in it, or to go out and find a strategic partner that wants your customers or your technology. And so oftentimes when that happens, there'll be a buyer out there that wants to buy your business, and you're able to sell it for approximately the value that's in the company. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So it's not necessarily that you get exactly $100,000 back if you raised $100,000, but usually you can get some money out of the business if you've built real technology or have customers or have, you know, a smart team. You can sell those assets to get the money back. Yeah.
So obviously, I've heard plenty of people talk about how business plans are kind of dead, and you know, nobody wants to look at 25-page documents. So what's replaced that?
So I think what's replaced that is an executive summary. Does everyone know what that is? It's basically a one-page document on, it's got your contact information, it's got, I think the most important thing you can do, and to try to take your question another way, but the most important thing you can do is perfect the elevator pitch. And the reason they call it that is because if you ever step into an elevator with someone, you might have three floors to say what you do. And I think it's a three-sentence pitch. The first sentence is what you do, and that is very concise. And I think you all have a good idea of what you do, but when asking you to explain it, it comes out a little bit garbled sometimes, or it gets kind of long and windy because you want to throw in every single feature you have. Like, we built a platform that does, you know, it mows the lawn and it waters your grass and it, you know, it cooks your breakfast and it toasts your toast and it sweeps the floor. And when really what you do is you've created a platform that automates your home, right? So stick to like the highest level thing that you do and be concise about it. So the first sentence is what you do. The second sentence is why does it matter? Why does anyone care? And sometimes they might not, but hopefully they do. And then the third thing is, why will you win? So let's say you're working on developing a new cancer vaccine, right? So I'm developing a new cancer vaccine that targets this gene. That's what I do. It matters because, as you know, every year, you know, hundreds of millions of people are dying from cancer, and we want to solve this problem. I think we can all agree that saving lives is meaningful, that matters. And then why will you win? We'll win because, you know, we're the only ones who are able to do this procedure because we've perfected it at this university and we have this technology, right? So that's maybe not the best example, but so for you it might be, and I know I'm going to butcher what you do, but please just bear with me. We've created a technology platform that allows users to share, share across any device, you know, with hand signals and motion, right? That might not be it, but I'm just saying that might be it. Yeah. And so why does it matter? Well, right now consumers are all restricted to, devices and screens, and to be able to release, to allow people to do work anywhere is very liberating. And we're going to win because we have the best hardware, because we have, the top developer from MIT, and on our board of advisors is Sergey Brin.
But as I know, they worked on it for 2 years.
Right, right. So I'm saying, but make sure you sort of work on your pitch and craft it that way, and try to say the most compelling things you can. So that was your question was about executive summary, but also the investor deck. There's like a 10-slide investor deck. If you guys email me, I'm happy to send around a template for that. The executive summary and the investor deck. The other thing I'll say is we've funded 40-some companies over the life cycle of our fund. Of that, a vast majority have come to us through trusted referrals. What I mean by that is we all have a network of people that we trust, whether it be lawyers, bankers, friends, people I went to university with. And when they call us and say, hey, check out this company, I think you'll really like it, it's far more likely to get my attention than if I get a cold email from someone and says, hey, check out my company, I'm doing this really cool thing. And that's just because people who know me know what we look for, they understand my business, they know what stuff we're into. And by coming through a trusted source, I'm going to take that a lot more seriously and credibly than something that just comes in through email. So if you can find a reason to get to me or other investors through people they know and trust, you're going to have a lot better chance of success of raising the money. What else? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd consider actually a third direction. Have you guys heard of incubators or accelerators?
We are now in that stage.
So, and often you can actually go into another one. I'm not saying you necessarily should, but once you graduate one, you might have to give up a little more equity, but you can go into another one. Because usually what I think some of the problems with accelerators and incubators is that when you get out, you don't have enough of a product developed to go out and raise like formal capital, but you're a lot further along than when you started. So like 3 more months or 6 more months with a program might help you land more customers, might help you debug the software, might help you do some other things, right? So another incubator accelerator might be a great way to go. If you're very early on and don't have a lot of customer traction or like a fully developed product, I would say go more towards the friends and family or angel route. If you've got software you can show and let people play with and you know who your customers are, now it's just a matter of selling and closing them, I'd say go more the traditional venture capital route. Each situation is so individualized, I'd have to spend a little more time with you understanding the product and where you're at in the life cycle. But depending on, you know, broadly which stage you're in, you know, those paths sort of vary. Yeah?
So, you know, you mentioned getting trusted referrals are your best bet in getting into this. So, I'm a college student.
Yeah.
And I'm about to graduate. And where do you, besides my professors, I don't really have, you know, how do you make that leap from being a college kid with a really cool idea to...
So how many people in here are in school and university right now? Okay. You guys are all very lucky because you are the most privileged group in the room right now, and I mean that in the nicest way possible. You can literally pick up the phone and call anyone and say, I am a college student working on this project. Will you talk to me? And 95% of people will say, yes, I will talk to you. Everyone wants to help a student. I don't know why. I'm really glad they do. I was a student once, and I used it to my advantage, but everyone wants to talk to a student, right? So first of all, for those students in the room, use it to your advantage before you graduate, right? And never lie, but there's ways to stretch whatever you're working on to make it fit into something else. So be creative, but don't lie. But seriously, pick up the phone and say, I'm attending this university. I saw that you do this thing. I'm working on this project. I'd really love to get, you know, 5 minutes of your time. Would you have 5 minutes of, you know, your time over the phone to talk about, you know, what I'm working on? So for you university students, it's a great way to build connections now. Do it. For those of you who aren't, it's a matter of starting to attend. I mean, right now, what's that? Yeah, exactly. Get one more degree. Go back to school. No. Spend more money. No. But, I mean, if you're here right now, you're already sort of a part of a group of trusted advisors and individuals around you, right? So I would make the most of an event like this, right? No matter what city you live in, I'm sure there's startup meetups or technology groups that get together or things like that. It's another great place to start. Don't spend all your time there. I'd say hit it really hard for like a couple weeks or a month and attend everything you can. And then step back and say, who are the key contacts I've met at these events and who do I want to follow up with? And then start building your core group of mentors that way. Don't spend months and months continuing to attend these things. You'll start to see the same people, you know, diminishing returns. But spend a lot of time early on doing that. The other thing I'll say is LinkedIn or other services like it have been very valuable to help you see who you're connected to and how you're connected. Certainly leverage professors, leverage events like this, leverage networking events, get to know people. The other thing is if you're going to do a cold outreach to someone, which, you know, I don't recommend, but you're going to have to. I've done it. Try to find something people are interested in, right? So, for example, I love Iowa Hawkeye football, which might mean something to you, might not to most of you. But if you send me an email and say, like, go Hawks in the subject line, I'm 10 times more likely to open your email and respond just because you've taken the time to get to know me, right? And it may have taken 30 minutes of searching the web to find me and find out where I work and what I'm interested in and what I do in my free time. I have a big dog. I'm a dog lover. If you send me something like dog lover seeking advice, I'd be like, oh, someone else likes dogs. I also like dogs. I'll answer their question, right? So if you're going to do a cold intro, please be creative in your subject line. Please think about why. Put yourself in that person's shoes and say, if I got a random email from someone I didn't know and had no connection, what would make me want to respond? And I guarantee if it's something you're interested in or you have common interests or things like that, you're more likely to respond. So just, it pays to be empathetic and think about what would I want to do in this situation? If I knew this person got 300 emails a day, why would I, or if I got 300 emails a day, why would I respond to this one over the other 299? So be creative, things like that. Yeah, what else? Yeah. What do I think about AngelList? I think it's an incredible resource. Never has there been so much visibility into startups and potential investors before. And so it's a great resource. I think there are occasionally reasons not to be on it, but for the most part, it's a great site to be on. Sorry. I guess I'll speak from what I think kind of the future holds. But again, each firm has their own sort of firm beliefs and where the next wave is. I really believe that part of the future is in content. I think content is still very important. And I think connected devices. I mean, there's this whole Internet of Things. And it can be everything from healthcare devices that we're wearing on our wrists to self-driving cars to everything else. But I really think connected devices is going to be a way of the future in terms of quantifying the data and everything else. And from our firm's perspective, we tend not to invest so much in the actual hardware or the actual end product. We like to invest the stages along the way. So with this proliferation of devices, there's going to be a huge amount of data coming out, right? If we can invest in the platform that manages that data across devices and makes sense of it, that's really attractive to us. If we can find a new way to market to end users based on this input data, that's really exciting to us. So we don't want to be in the hardware at the end or at the consumer-facing product necessarily. We like to be at some of those verticals in between that deal with media and other stuff. So, yeah.
What is, for example, for you is the decision-making point for investing in a company? Like sometimes they're saying that the main thing is team, the main thing is idea, or is the core business, so which one?
I'll take an incredible team with a terrible idea over an incredible idea with a mediocre team. Smart people that are really driven tend to figure things out. And more often than not, at the early stage where we invest, things don't work out. I guarantee pretty much every business in our portfolio is doing something different than when we first gave them money. It might be just, by one degree different. It might be an entirely different, 360-degree different business, right? But smart, driven people that are passionate about what they're doing are going to find a way to succeed or fail, but they're going to do it as quickly as possible. Whereas a great idea, you and I can sit here and talk about ideas all day, and an idea doesn't make a successful business. I've seen people with really mediocre ideas sell businesses for $100 million, and I've seen the most ingenious idea fall flat on its face because it lacks execution. So I'll take execution and team any day. Not necessarily any day, but most days over the business. What do you mean by the foundation of the company? Oh, of how we were formed? So we started in 2002, and we were actually started as a sort of economic impact fund. So we have a lot of investment from CalPERS, which is California Pension and Employee Retirement System. So we manage money for a lot of retirees in the state of California. When we started that fund, they wanted to do job creation to make an economic impact in some of the more rural communities like Sacramento and other areas around it. So our first fund, we raised money and invested in those communities to try to stimulate job creation. Our second fund, a bigger fund we raised, and we sort of had a new mission of investing in sort of defensible, technology-related businesses. And so every 5 years or 6 years, we're out raising a new fund to go and continue to fund startups. Right now we're looking for media information services deals. We're looking for defensible technologies. We're looking for really strong teams. But it started in 2002, and so we're now in our 11th year, continuing to grow and raise and get bigger. Yeah. Oh, sure. One more question? Two more questions? Yeah.
What's the most successful team that you've got?
It's like asking which of your children is your favorite, right? Like, nobody wants to say, oh, I love my daughter more than that, right? But, so we're part of the DFJ network, and I would say Skype is the biggest name we invested in. Baidu, Skype, Hotmail. Rocketmail became Hotmail, and that's been a huge success. So those names are all part of our family funds of DFJ. There's like 16 funds around the globe. We're one of them, and we've been in those deals as part of the network.
Sell the business or whatever. Is there, can you still look for VC funding and then say buy the VCs out, pretty much.
Sure, no, and that's a great outcome. Oftentimes, the type of businesses that receive venture funding don't necessarily cash flow in the right way to provide enough liquidity to founders to buy the VCs back out.
Right.
But that can certainly be done, and a lot of times what will happen is secondary funds will come in, like big private equity firms will come and buy out the position of the venture fund, and then you'll have another 10 years to go and do your thing, or indefinitely. So there are ways to do that. Yeah. So thank you very much. I'll be around for a little while if you guys want to ask questions one-on-one in the back of the room or outside. Thanks for listening. I hope it was helpful. And please email or call, seriously. I promise I will. You got to figure it out. Thanks, guys.
Hey, guys, just
feedback form. Hold on. Please fill out the evaluation form.